link session number 2 8 8 9 8, real 9.
Max Charlesworth, real 9. Where were you posted to after your refresher course?
I was posted to 124 Squadron at West Balling in Kent, where our main job there was escorting American fortresses and British Lancasters and heavy bombers as far as we could get into Europe.
Had the Spitfires been modified at that stage?
Yeah, we had long-range tanks. We had a 90-gallon long-range tank, which enabled us to get in a bit further. We could get that in as far as Hamburg, Frankfurt am Main. We couldn't get all the way into Berlin like the Mustangs could, but we could get them quite a long way in.
How did the drop tanks operate? How would you operate them? Would you run the drop tank first and then...
Yes, again, it was a bit typically British, haphazard. You rang your drop tank till it ran dry and your engine stopped, and you switched your main tanks. There was no sort of easy air, smooth transition. Or somebody would tell you. It had no gauge on the drop tank, so you didn't know how much fuel it had in there when it stopped. And then you just changed over very quickly to the main tanks.
And how would you jettison your drop tank?
Well, you just had a round pedal on the floor with a pole going through, which hit the fire, and it stamped it, and it just dropped, knocked it off. All homemade stuff. And sometimes it fell off, and sometimes it was just jammed. Wouldn't fall off.
What was your role when you joined the squadron? Did you join as a flight commander or?
I joined that squadron as a flight lieutenant. I became a flight commander in that squadron later on, but I didn't join as a flight commander. Interesting. Yes, the first aircraft I flew on that squadron was a Spitfire 7. Now, Spitfire 7 was a most unusual aeroplane. It was pressurised, had long wingtips, and our job was to get right up as high as we could, which was touching 50,000 feet. Now, that's very, very high for a piston engine aircraft. And bloody cold. Extremely cold. So we had a Heath Robinson-type electrical suiting, which consisted of slippers like this. They were just like slippers. They weren't made of leather. They were made of some material with electrodes running through, with a lead going up here to a sort of jacket which you wrapped around yourself, put your arms through it, and a lead coming up here the same way, and you'd plug that into the aircraft, and that was supposed to keep you warm. But sometimes the leads from the legs would fail, and your foot would absolutely freeze. But it's minus 60 degrees centigrade there, you know. There's no proper heating in a spit. It's full of holes. It's not pressurized. Well, no, this wasn't. This was pressurized, so it should have heated, but heating wasn't good. It was funny because when they put the hood on, they clamped you in from outside. So you couldn't get if you wanted to bail out, you had to electronically blow the hood off, which little devices on bolts would explode the bolts and would fly off. And that was a bit claustrophobic to me, and I thought funny. And clamped into it, because you always took off with the hood open in a Spitfire. Then when you were airborne, you just slammed it too. But that was a very peculiar aircraft. It was. Yeah, we did a lot of. The idea was to go up and down the channel looking for being directed towards their high flying photographic reconnaissance aircraft. JU-86, I think, was one of the ones that used to get very high, and we had to go out to them, so we used to patrol them down the channel. But it was most extraordinary because they really were high. And then we came off those and went back to ordinary Spit-9s.
Do aircraft perform differently at those kind of heights?
Well, if you've got longer wingtips, laterally they're stiffer, they're more difficult to roll. But basically it was the same. I don't think it had anything else on it apart from this peculiar pressurisation system and clamp-on hood. But I think there's only one squadron of those ever built. I think that was a squadron we had. I think, I'm not sure, but I think. But a very funny aeroplane.
And the aim was really to dissuade any kind of photo reconnaissance aircraft making trips over the British Isles,
wasn't it? The radar was exceptionally good. It really was. Our controllers from wherever they could control, New Biggin Hill or wherever it was. When we went out as a pair for morning reconnaissance, the voice would come up on us. They didn't know who was flying. They obviously were told, I suppose, by our station. And the controller would come and say, hello, Max and Dick, or whoever. Morning, Max and Dick. So I said, morning, who's that? I said, oh, Jim here. Okay, Jim. Right, steer, go to height, you're flying a bit wide apart this morning. The radar was so good, you could tell. I said, oh, well, we're just relaxing a bit. And but they were very good. They'd say, well, we've got two aircraft about 100 miles down the channel, up at about 48,000 feet. So steer so, and go and have a look at see what they are. But I don't think we ever caught any aircraft or even saw them at that height. So if they came in when we weren't a particular place where they came in. Well, they had radar too, I suppose they could see where we were.
And were they doing it on a daily basis?
Yeah, we used to patrol all day long, the two of us up there all day, just going up and down the channel. But that was a very short period we had Spit 7s, it wasn't very long, we didn't do anything apart from that sort of activity. We didn't do any sweeps or anything like that, or escorts. And then we got back onto Spit 9s, which were, again, I hadn't flown a Spit 9 before. That was quite a very different aircraft from the Spit 5, but much more powerful, a lot of torque. If you took off with the throttle wide open, you'd just go straight over on your back. The torque from the engine was so great that the contra-centrifugal forces of the aircraft the other way, it would just tip the aircraft on straight over. So you had to open the throttle very gently, keep full rudder on, stick hard over towards the way they're going, and then slowly as you got down the runway, you open the throttle more and more and put the stick central. And once you were airborne, of course, it went up like a bird. It was fantastic. A very nice Spit 9 was the most powerful aircraft I flew during the war. And that was pretty much on a par with the 190, but not quite. The German pilots who flew the 190 said they didn't like it. It used to vibrate like mad. They always thought the engine was going to stop. But they were very good aeroplanes. High rate of roll, tremendous high rate of roll. They could flick on their backs and away like mad. But the Spit 9 was a very good aircraft. It was with a long-range tank, we could go quite a long way in. But it was... You see, flying forts and our heavy bombers, they used to fly in formation, and they would clip the tops of clouds and go through them, because they can't go over the top or around them, because they're a massive fleet of them. And so you're always flying in, so sometimes you're flying through wisps of cloud or something, and have to keep your eye open the whole time. And then Spit 9s, of course, which wasn't air conditioned, wasn't air pressurized, rather, it was very, very, very cold. And, or feet used to actually freeze. Because, as I say, up at that region, it's normal over Europe, over the whole Earth, actually, up at about 35,000 feet, it's always about minus 60 degrees centigrade. And that's fairly nippy. And you'd get ice forming up on the side of the perspex sometimes. But, they were long, boring, cold trips.
Had the cockpit layout changed at all in the Spitfire 9 from before?
No, not really.
Did it remain basically the same sort of layout?
Yes, it was the same. The Spitfire cockpit was the same. Apart from the automatic, the Spit 1 had a pump undercarriage system. But when they got the sort of proper little lever you had to push down here, back and down and up, it remained the same. can't remember any difference. I just can't remember any difference at all.
Were the changes in the canopy hood though?
The canopy, yes. We've got the first Spitfire hoods were a bit restrictive. If I remember right, they were flat sided. Then they got a sort of bulb sided, and they got a real teardrop that went all the way back. So you had a little mirror up here, just outside the aircraft, but there, so you could see behind you. It was a sort of wide angle mirror, which wasn't a lot of good because you wanted to see aircraft further than the mirror could see them, and it didn't.
It didn't change how you were reacting.
No, you depended upon looking. Always dependent on your own eyes.
Had it improved your visibility though as you were looking behind?
The structure of the cockpit hood was very much better in this latter aircraft. It was bigger and you had very good visibility, you could see out quite well.
Now you mentioned obviously these were quite long, boring things, these escorting American bombers. How would they be organised? Where would you formate on them, or would you meet at a certain point?
The day would start with the alarm going on right across the station, saying all pilots report to the briefing room at 7:30 hours or something like that. So you'd all go down there, like a little theatre, sit in the seats, and a big stage, great big screen, and a great big map of Europe. And then the wing commander would get up and say, right, draw the curtains back. This is the moment we waited for, the curtains drawing back. Crash, it had full of red lines and blue lines and yellow lines of different aircraft and different bomber groups and things that were going off at the same time. And we'd look for hours and, we're there again. Oh dear, that's pretty heavily defended there. Oh, dear, well, here we go. Then he'd brief us on what was going on. He said, well, you're going here. 450 B-17s there, 70, what was it on?
B-24
that going in there. Bomber commander doing a raid down there, about 400 of those are going down there. And we've got about, 8 wings of fighters, that would be about 800 fighters all. Will be taking part, and they're from these bases. Our wing will be doing out of top cover, high cover, close for diversionary sweep before the whole thing started to get the fighters going. But yeah, just a general briefing. Then a Met man would, then he'd say, the intelligence officer would then come up. And he'd say, we do know that they've got some more anti-aircraft batteries here, and we do know that the fighter squadron has moved into here and here, so expect activity there. And they've got a better radar system, seems to be picking aircraft up. Just a general intelligence picture. Then the weatherman would get up and he said, you expect 10,000 feet and whatever the weather would be. And because getting probably 1,500 aircraft up at the same time from the lower part of England, all at about the same time, except the flying force. They'd start to take off 2 hours before it was due. They'd take off and go round and round, flying off their pistols to identify themselves and to pick up till the whole formation had gathered. And then to see the flying fortresses setting off, streaming silver, bright silver in the sun, streaming contrails behind them. It was a sight to behold. The air was just one massive silver armada going towards Germany. Must have frightened the living daylights out of the Germans. Whereas, you see, Bomber Command flew in a stream. They should have flown in boxes of four, with one in the box had H2S, which was a radar device for bombing through cloud, which the Americans never have. And they could actually see the target through cloud and bomb through cloud. So when he dropped his bomb, the other three in the same group of four dropped the bomb. The bomber command never flew formation, never practiced it, so it was a bit straggly. So it would be when they had 1,000 aircraft flying towards the target, it went on forever. The stream was way back there, and the front of it was way back up from horizon to horizon. It's stream. But I often wonder what they must have thought of the Germans when they saw this talk coming towards them. It must have scared the hell out of them. And then you see them dropping their bombs with it. Well, I remember one of the last raids of the war, they decided to put Heligoland out of action as a naval base forever. So 800 Lancasters bombed this tiny island of Heligoland with 800-pound bombs, whatever they had. Not 800 pounds, sorry, 8,000 pound bombs, big bombs. And we escorted them. And we patrolled back and forth on the German side of the, just to intercept any aircraft that would come coming into the hotel. And you've never seen anything like it. There are groups of hundreds at a time would go across and bomb this island. And the first time we bombed it, flak would come up like mad. Oh, tremendous amount of flak. And it was fairly covered in dust and smoke and sand and stuff when the first, imagine 100 bombing a small island. And then the second group bombed it, little boats were putting out sea from this third group bombing. And when the eighth had gone, you couldn't see the island. It was a mushroom cloud higher than we were, would come up and spit out all dust and sand and debris and whatever. And it would, as we left it, I looked back. Just looked exactly like an atom bomb had hit it, but it just destroyed Heligoland. I mean, it was we saw the reconnaissance pictures afterwards, and it was just like a pockmarked moon surface. You know, it was just a mass of holes. Nothing standing or moving or anything.
When you scouted the Americans, you've described them obviously taking off and heading towards Germany. Would you then rendezvous with them?
Oh yes, we'd have a point. Normally somewhere like the Dutch Islands or some point on the French coast, perhaps.
Would it always be before you got over the coast? Or would you?
Yes, before we got over the coast. Yes, generally. Yes, before we got over the coast. And then that's when we knew we were getting closer because they started firing at us. they were shot. They shot at us all the way in, all the way out.
But, was that an assumption on their part that...
No, Americans, they're in Iraq, they shoot anything that moves. Anything that's not theirs that moves. Even if it's theirs, it's near them, and fire at it. They were terrible. They were. They shot. It's the first time we did close escort to them, the very first time we ever went with them, we were doing close escort that day. We flew in to get very close to them and took up our position in close escort. And as we close in, I saw a tracer coming out. This massive tracer coming out of these aircraft. So I thought, well, God, don't they know we're escorting them? I've never been briefed about this, which of course they had. And so I went up, gave them a plan view, because Spitfire has a very good plan view. And all air crew spend a lot of time doing aircraft recognition, you know, so you can recognize any type of aircraft, what make it is and what market it is of that make sometimes. But they couldn't care less. It's coming near me, mate. Well, I don't know who it is. Shoot at it. And go anywhere near their ships, they fire at you. They just fired at everything that moved. I see they're doing the same thing in Iraq or wherever, anywhere else they are. But they did. I mean, we just have the occasional American escort ship on convoys. We have Sunderland or Americans would send out Catalinas to escort a convoy. And if it came down between the ships, it would get riddled all the way down. They would fire it all the way down. And as soon as the American ships opened fire, so did the Royal Navy. They thought, they must know something we don't know. And anything that came anywhere near the convoy was shot up in the air.
So with the American bomber formations, how close was close escort in that case?
Well, it's pretty close. It was, I suppose, I don't know, probably 20, 30 feet between each aircraft, something like that.
But would you be out of gunfire range?
Well, we'd be up at one side, they'd be all down here, and we'd be up here somewhere, perhaps one side of. Would be up here, then another close escort squadron would be that side of them, and the escort cover to protect the escort fighters. There'd be escort cover up here, then there'd be high cover to protect the escort cover. So there'd be quite a pyramid of aircraft, all with specific jobs for being there for specific reasons. But I mean, you know, when you see 1,000 aircraft in the air, it's a dramatic sight, really is dramatic.
at that stage, obviously, you've been fighting in those operations and across the channel in 1941, where there have been high casualties, and then you'd experienced the merchant naval condition, really. And at this stage, did you obviously think this was, you could see the growing power of the Air Force?
Yes, no doubt about it. We'd blasted all the enemy aircraft practically out of northern France.
I was going to say, was there much opposition when you were doing these escort raids at all in daylight?
Very little air opposition. Well, as far as we were concerned, as they got further towards Berlin or their targets, they probably got more, because they did, I suppose the Germans thought, well, they wouldn't have sort of a big escort or something. But they did. They got fired at. They got attacked by Messerschmitt 262s. And
would they be attacked once you as an escort would have to return?
I can't remember any escort that we did where we actually saw enemy fighters attacking the bombers.
So it was really later.
I mean, the early stage, we saw quite a lot of them being attacked by my first duty of Air Force pilot, 11 Group. Westmoreland was 11 Group, but I mean, when I was at Kenley, you know, the 41 period I'm talking about. The Pas-de-Calais area of France was stacked full of German fighters. They were doing attacks on British dive bombing attacks and low level attacks on our ports in the south of England. So you knew as soon as you crossed into France you were going to meet German enemy aircraft. But they'd all moved back, and of course I think the invasion was on then. Well, 43, I hadn't started when I first started at Westmoreland.
They had moved back from that initial place where you used to see them in the kind of front line of France, and they moved back into Germany.
Yeah, moved back further back. Many of them, I don't know why, but we didn't see them at all. No, I didn't see them at all. I can't remember an escort where we actually saw enemy fighters at that period. But I may have done, I just can't remember when so many of them.
So the main threats really were from friendly fire from America.
And that flak hack was a very heavy, flak they used to put up. It's a black cloud. First of all, they had black dots, and then puffs of smoke, really. This is the enemy 88mm gun, which is a very accurate gun. And that would start appearing in bursts, and then it would get thicker and thicker until how am I going to get hit by one of those? Which I was, I think I told you, until I was went out on this mission. Four shells fired up through solid cloud, four shots. When we were flying at about 32,000 feet, 35,000 feet, one hit my friend, one hit me out of four. That's right, radar controlled, 88mm fire. So yes, the air was black with flak, absolutely, and most of the damage was done by flak. And Americans used to suffer 80-90% battle damage. But somehow their aircraft were very strong. They used to get back. They would crash land all over the south of England. But they suffered a great casualty. They suffered the 8th Air Force in America in Britain. As our chaps did, they suffered the same.
And was this a relatively easy period, considering your last periods of action that you've been in?
It was, yes, that was a lull in a sort of a nervous period, yes. It was boring. Sometimes we'd have to go to, when they captured parts of France, we'd have to go to four airfields and escort them from there so we could get further in. That was a boring, cold, boring bit of flying. But occasionally we used to have to do special things. We used to do things called rhubarbs. That was a name for them, code name for them. Well, a code name, we all knew what it was. Well, two of us would fly in low level and attack targets on the coast if there were any. We would just attack targets of opportunity, really. If you saw something that was German, you just blew it away if you could.
What would you be looking for?
Anything. Any German activity. But those tended to die away as they moved further back. And then, when I'd finished that West Morning, I was supposed to Coltishall on dive bombing. That's a different story. I can't remember now whether it was the end of 44 or the beginning of 45, but we were suddenly, the whole squadron moved up to Coltishaw. There was a wing of Spitfires, there was a Polish squadron, 303, the original Polish squadron, but all the old timers had gone, and they weren't quite the sort of, they were rather loose cannons, I'm afraid. And then there was another squadron, and our squadron, 124 squadron. And we were suddenly introduced to a totally new role. We dive bombing. Well, I never thought of dive bombing in a Spitfire before, but our job, it was just at a time when the V2s were plummeting into London, and they were trying to stop them getting to the in Holland where they were launched, from where they were launched. And so they wanted, our job was to interdict the railway lines and to bomb the actual sites from where they were launched and try and cut down the flow of them, because they were coming across at increasing numbers. And so I was staggered when I saw Spitfire standing there with a 500-pound bomb under its belly, which is pretty big for a Spitfire, and a 250-pound bomb under each wing. Spitfire's quite a small plane, really. And that's an extra £1,000 worth of weight. But because of Spit 9 is a powerful engine, there's no problem taking off. But this dive bombing thing, we thought, what do we do here? How do we dive bomb?
Did it affect the performance, or was there a lot of drag with the bombs?
Well, there's not a. Well, it was such a powerful engine in the Spit 9 that you didn't really notice it. We flew out fairly low. And I was leading the squadron quite a lot of the time then, because I don't know what happened to the squadron commander we had, but he had gone somewhere and we were waiting for another one. And so I was senior flight commander, so I was leading the squadron on lots of these raids. And we used to fly low out over the sea towards Holland to keep under the radar screen. And then at the last moment we would climb up to bombing height. And then, of course, because these sites were in little parks and little green areas in the centre of The Hague, it was very difficult, first of all, although we had photographs of them before we went, PR, photo reconnaissance, photographs of them from the. It was very hard to identify them when you're actually flying up there. And, of course, we climbed up to 12,000 feet, which was midway between the heavy AK-AK, 88mm, and the Bofors 20mm and 40mm guns that were low down, so we weren't getting an awful lot of problem with flak. Because they were places where they launched these V2 bombs from, sort of static places, always there, they were very heavily defended, had guns all around them. And so as soon as we got up to 12,000 feet and started moving in, they knew what we were going to do, and they wound their guns around. And so the idea was to go straight to the target, identify it, get into echelon starboard. Our technique was to wait for the target to go under the front wing of the Spitfire, and as soon as it appeared out of the back of the Spitfire, we just half-rolled into it, do a vertical dive. And that was when the fun started, because the gunners were all trained on, here they come. They got their guns absolutely trained on us. And the flak was a problem there. It really was frightening. Because you had a whole, the gun sight, we used this as a bomb sight. I forget how we used to use it now, but we used to put the dot of the gun sight, which reflected onto the swing in the front. I can't remember whether it was just below the target or just ahead of it. But we kept that steady on the spot and dived from 12,000 feet down to, I think it was about 2,500 when we used to release the bomb. So, or the bombs, depending upon what we were carrying. And of course, you started running into the heavy ground flak at about 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 feet, and it was just like us, like flying into a rain shower, but a very heavy rain shower, because this stuff used to come up towards us very slowly,